Thank you. This is actually a nice companion piece to the preceding talk, because we're also going to talk about some sort of preliminary efforts toward accomplishing the kind of translational goal that was discussed earlier this morning. I just want to mention that the work I'm talking about is done in collaboration with my wife, Judy, who is here, plus, of course, a cast of thousands of postdocs and graduate students and so on. Sort of setting a little bit of context, about 10 years ago, Judy and I wrote a review article called Distance Matters, where we sort of took stock of what was known about the issues involved and the obstacles to overcome in working at a distance. And I should say, by the way, that our work on collaboration has all been about distributed collaborations, when people are not in the same location. And if you know Tom Allen's pioneering work, published a number of years ago, essentially 30 meters is what we're talking about with distance collaboration. If you're 30 meters away from people, you could just as well be on the other side of the world as far as things like communication, frequency, and so on. So many of the kind of collaborations we're talking about are distance collaborations. For example, we've been involved with some colleagues in the medical school at UC Irvine. And the medical school and the university hospital are in Orange, which is about, well, on a good day, about a 25-minute drive on freeways. And so they're constantly using things like video conferencing and audio conferencing and so on. So even within the UC campus, it's a true distance collaboration. Anyway, back around the turn of the century, it was published in 2000, we kind of reviewed where things were at in terms of what's involved in trying to successfully work at a distance. In the intervening decade, with support from the National Science Foundation, we focused pretty exclusively on collaborations in science and engineering. And this resulted in a book we just published a couple years ago called Scientific Collaboration on the Internet, in which we reviewed work. We actually found more than 200 examples of scientific collaboration at a distance. We did sort of serious case studies of several dozen of those, and the book contains a number of these case studies in a wide variety of areas of science. The chapter 4 in this book has what we call a theory of remote scientific collaboration, and it itself would be easily an hour-long talk. I just want to give you sort of some highlights. We've identified something on the order of 4 dozen or more factors that we have seen that differentiate successful from unsuccessful distance collaborations. And I should say, by the way, there's a lot of failure out there. I mean, collaboration is hard. When you throw distance in as yet another factor, things often don't go very well. And so there's a sort of a rich array of examples of failed collaborations. There are also successful collaborations. And we sort of divided these 3 or 4 dozen factors into some general categories, and I'll just kind of mention them briefly. One is the nature of the work. Not every kind of thing you want to do can be done easily if you're not in the same location. There are certain kinds of tasks that require sort of really intense interaction with your colleagues, things like early design stages in activities and so on, where it's very hard to do these at a distance. Whereas other kinds of work are easily divided and distributed among participants and then, you know, brought together again on various occasions. So what you're trying to do is one key sort of factor in this. Second key factor is what we call common ground. That is, what do the participants in the collaboration share in terms of knowledge, vocabulary, understanding? This is especially stressed, as you might well imagine, in interdisciplinary collaborations where people come from different backgrounds, may use the same words, but they mean different things. We've particularly seen this in cases where computer scientists are collaborating with engineers. Terms like system and requirement have totally different meanings in these two different communities. And one project we did in earthquake engineering, we saw all kinds of trouble for the first several years of the project because they just didn't, they used the same words, but they weren't meaning the same thing. Collaboration readiness, that's the prenuptial agreement we saw this morning is a good example of something along those lines. How ready are the people able to work together? Partly it's based on experience. Obviously, if you're collaborating with people you've worked with a lot before, your collaboration readiness is probably fairly high. But there are plenty of dragons in this area. Actually, one of the most serious complications we've seen in the examples we looked at was when collaboration is mandated by a funder. Those are some of the riskiest kinds of collaborations. And of course, people are always trying to find money, and so they'll often put together collaborations in order to get money. We actually saw some examples in the e-science program in England, where people, you know, wrote these beautiful proposals, said we're going to work together. This sounded really nice and cheery. The minute they got the money, they just went their separate ways, and that's not an uncommon pattern in these kinds of things. The kind of prenuptial agreement that was talked about this morning, we've actually seen examples of this that are several decades old. We spent quite a lot of time studying the upper atmospheric physics community. These are people who study the things like the northern lights and things happening in the upper atmosphere. And they, several decades ago, wrote up what they call rules of the road. And it covers many of the areas that were covered in the prenuptial agreement example that we saw. We began working with them in the early 90s, introducing them to sort of internet-based collaboration, because previously most of their collaborations had been done co-located. They would we focused particularly on a community that was doing data collection in Greenland. They would fly up there, spend several weeks up there collecting data and interacting with each other and so on. And over the course of a decade, we made it possible for them to do that kind of work over the internet then added other kind of resources as we went along. Well, they realized once we had changed the way they could do their science, they had to revisit their rules of the road, because things like data sharing and so on were very different under the new regime of sort of internet-based collaboration. And so they actually formed committees and did that. So that was an example, and that's sort of an example of a community that is very successful in their collaborations, and they because they really thought through the issues carefully a long time ago. Technology readiness has to do with what level of sophistication you have about technology. Now, when we first began doing this work in the late 80s, early 90s, technology sophistication was pretty scattered. And we looked at a lot of communities, particularly in the medical area, where the participants didn't have much technical sophistication. And for example, when we started working with the space physicists, we thought we could do a lot of our project coordination by email. And most of them weren't using email back in the late 80s, early 90s. They, of course, came along over the course of the decade that we worked with them. But when you begin to work with people and try to introduce them to collaborative technologies, you got to be sensitive to where they are. Even today, we did some work last summer with the medical school at UC Irvine, and we discovered that very few of the people that we were surveying were familiar with things like Facebook and Twitter and some of the things that a lot of us take for granted these days. So even today, when the technologies are so pervasive, not everybody is doing everything, and you have to be sort of sensitive to that. Management, planning, and decision making. It turns out managing a geographically distributed project is difficult, and it's the people who are good at it are not necessarily the same people who are good at managing co-located projects. When people are scattered around, you have to be much more proactive in keeping their interests in mind, in communicating with them, making sure that they're confident of your decision-making regimes and so on. And we've seen plenty of examples of projects where the science was excellent, at least the scientific goals were excellent, but these projects were just not managed very well. And that's a really key feature when you're doing these kind of distributed projects. They say there's a sort of more complicated story behind all this, and if you want the details, chapter 4 in the book I referred to would be a starting point. We're actually working on a monograph that we hope to finish up by the end of the summer. There'll be an even more detailed account of this story. Now, having understood this, we are interested in getting this knowledge into the hands of people who are trying to do collaborative science. And so we have built something called the Collaboration Success Wizard. And essentially, it's a kind of online embodiment of the theory of remote scientific collaboration. It's a sort of online survey. It takes about 20 to 30 minutes to go through it. And we have three sort of flavors of it, depending on what kind of project we're looking at. There's one version that focuses on projects that are completed. This is kind of just a way for us to gather some data about what might have happened in an earlier project. A second version is for a project you're in the middle of right now, and could potentially serve as a sort of mid-course correction if some difficulties are surfaced. And then a third one is for projects you're thinking about doing. We've actually so far been putting a lot of our effort into that third one, because that's particularly interesting to us. Because what we'd like to be able to do is assess a project before it starts, give them some feedback about things they might want to do or change in their collaboration, and then follow them, of course, find out what happened. Did these interventions make a difference? Did they succeed where they might have had some serious risk before. So when you take the, when you fill out the wizard, at the end of it, you're offered the option of a report. And this report will tell you that, you know, these, in certain areas, your collaboration looks strong, it looks fine, and so on. Here are some areas that maybe have some problems, and here's some things you could do about them. We suggest some interventions. We're right in the midst of sort of developing this, doing a lot of user testing. I mean, when you, a lot of our earlier work was done with interviews. And when you're interviewing somebody, it's very easy to tell whether they understood your question or not. But when you're doing an online survey, that's a lot trickier. So we've been doing a lot of testing of the online survey where we're watching people as they take it, getting feedback from them about whether they understand the intent of our questions or not. We did a trial administration last summer with a group in the UC Irvine Medical School that was working on a CTSA proposal. We got about 70 names from them of people who were going to be involved in this project. About 40 of them actually completed the wizard. We sort of gathered all that those data together, summarized it, and then made a report back to the steering committee of that project, which they found very informative, because we were able to identify across these 40 people who completed it a number of areas that were very strong, things that were good about the project, that people felt good about and felt confident about. But we also identified some things that they had questions about. Things like, one example was, since it was a very interdisciplinary collection of people, some worry about whether my interests would be watched over by the steering committee or by the PI, the leadership of the project. A second area was, how is the funding going to work? How are funding decisions going to be made? How are they going to get distributed? Again, will my interests be taken into account when that happens, and so on? And the third that really particularly surprised the steering committee was, how is intellectual property going to be handled? And so what they did was, after getting this feedback, and then we discussed with them possible interventions they could do to remedy some of these problems, they actually, in their proposal to NIH, put that language in there. They said that, you know, some experts on collaboration had surveyed their project, the participants in the project, had given them some feedback, and they were, here's some of the things they were going to do for the things that needed some work, some additional work. That was a sort of a very courageous step on their part to do that. We have another trial pending. We've been talking to a group at the University of Pittsburgh, actually in the area of craniofacial science, having to do with orthodontics. And they're putting together, they have an emerging consortium of universities in that area. And we're very likely going to be doing another trial of the collaboration success wizard with them. We expect to go public with this very soon. And by going public, what I mean is there will be a website that you can go to and request to be surveyed by the wizard team. We want to have some ability to screen who does this so we get the sort of legitimate projects. And then we'll, you know, if you make that request and it seems reasonable, we will then, you know, give you and your participants login and sign password information and so on to access the wizard. Furthermore, if it's a project that has, you know, multiple participants, we also are willing to then provide the same kind of summary and feedback that we did with the two projects that we've, the project at Irvine last year and the project at Pittsburgh coming up. As I say, this is going to be, there'll be a website shortly. And it sounds like there's going to be a mailing list for this conference, so we can send you the URL for that website, or you can, if you are even more eager, you can contact me, and my email address is there. So this is, as I say, sort of a tentative step toward doing the kind of translational work that was talked about this morning. I just want to briefly end with kind of a little description about where we're going with sort of our next wave of work. A topic that hasn't come up here a lot last couple of days is the whole issue of cultural differences. And, you know, in doing our project and on collaboration, we bumped into this a lot, that we see that people have, you know, especially international collaborations, people, you know, stumble over certain kinds of issues, you know, differences about how decisions might be made, some conversational differences that kind of get in the way from time to time. So we bumped into this, but now what we're doing with some new funding is we're going to move this into the foreground of our work. And when we talk about culture, we don't mean just national culture. We also talk about organizational culture. I always remember doing a project with some people in the business school at the University of Michigan when we were in Shanghai interviewing somebody at Hewlett-Packard's new office in Shanghai, and we said, what's your job here? This was the guy who was head of that office. He says, my job is to bring the Hewlett-Packard way of thinking into this organization. So there's this kind of this very explicit sense. A lot of organizations think about their culture quite explicitly. And then, of course, professional culture, which we find is an issue with interdisciplinary collaborations. For a whole variety of reasons, I guess primarily because we're in Southern California, we're going to focus initially on the Pacific Rim, on projects that involve collaborations between probably North America and various parts of Asia. And we'll be looking at that. And another reason for looking at this is these kinds of collaborations stress the whole issue of time zones, which are really critical. In fact, in most collaborations involving North America and Asia, there's little or no overlap in the workday. And so what this tends to do is put a premium on asynchronous interactions. And quite frankly, the available toolkits for asynchronous collaboration are much weaker than what we have for synchronous collaborations. So this will allow us to sort of focus on that and get some ideas for further tool development. Thank you.